Well, I'm just going to check one more thing, and if I can't find it, then we'll move on. But I know I have a copy of this document. I had it open earlier in the week, and then I closed it when I was working on something else. All right. I'm not going to waste any more time trying to find it. Unfortunately, I might be able to grab it this way. I have a copy of this document. I'm just going to have to portray this when we get to the spot, just to, for the sake of time. All right, let's get started. Sorry about that. You guys should have in front of you a set of notes for lesson 220, the AV 1611, examining the marginal notes. We're going to be looking at the Apocrypha and Codex Vaticanus in this particular lesson. So if you're joining us right now online and you would like to follow along, if you go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, you can go to under recent sermons, click on December 10. If you click on that link, you can open the notes and follow along with us here as we present the material in class from wherever you're at. So lesson 220, the AV 1611, examining the marginal notes, Apocrypha and Codex Vaticanus. Let's get right into the introduction. So just before teaching lesson 228 on Sunday, November 26th, that was what, last week or the week before?
2 weeks
ago, okay. A friend of the class, Alex Hanna, alerted me to the existence of marginalia in the apocryphal section of the 1611 that explicitly referenced Codex Vaticanus. So I jumped on Monday during my lunch break onto Joel Hayes' Grace Life podcast for about 20 minutes, and he was asking me about the notes from last week on Lucifer, and there was a little bit of a discussion on that, and I had mentioned in passing that we were going to be talking about this, and that there were notes in the 1611 on Codex Vaticanus, and he was like, oh no, that can't be, blah blah blah. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but he was surprised. I was surprised to find this out, so I spent some time looking at it. So please recall that I had originally said that I was not interested in the marginalia found in the Apocrypha, and that we would be focusing on the marginal notes appended to the canonical books of the Old and New Testaments exclusively. So I said that, and then my original intention was not to look at the Apocrypha, because as a Protestant, I just simply don't care. I don't view them as legitimate witnesses to the text of Scripture, and so I just was going to focus on the Old and New Testaments. Okay. However, when I heard this, I sort of thought maybe I'd better look. So after hearing from Brother Hanna, I decided to read all the marginal notes in the Apocrypha section of the 1611. So I got out my 1611 reprint, and I just read all the apocryphal notes in that entire section, okay, because I'm like, all right, what's in here? After doing so, I concluded that one lesson addressing the marginalia found in the 1611 Apocrypha was in order. All told, we'll be covering the following points in this lesson. We're going to look first at additional markings and this lettering system that I'll show you here in a second. We're going to be looking at a couple occurrences of the phrase some copies in the Apocrypha. Now, we've already seen that phrase when we looked at the Old and the New Testaments, all right? And then we're going to be looking at references to Codex Vaticanus, or the Roman copy, as it is referred to in the notes, all right? So let's look at that first category, additional markings lettering system. First, there's a different convention regarding the marking of marginalia observable in some portions of the Apocrypha. Thus far, we've noted the following three markings in the canonical text. We've noted number one, with the dagger, literal translations. With the two vertical lines, we've looked at English, alternative English renderings, and occasionally textual variants. And again, there are 20 of those explicitly noted. We talked about Scrivener and how he is kind of identifying more retroactively, and so I'm limiting mine to only the ones that are explicitly marked. And then we had the asterisk, which was marking the cross references. So we've talked about the dagger, the two vertical lines, and the asterisk so far. There are multiple places though in the Apocrypha exhibiting a lettering system that is unlike anything one encounters in the Old and New Testaments. Consider the following examples from 1 Esdras 9. So page 2 is a fairly large image, okay? Now I want to point out a couple things here about this image. Notice that it starts right here with an A, and then you go to the margin and there's an A. And then you go to another name and there's a B, and then you come over to the margin and there's a B. And this carries on like this all the way down, starting with A and ending with L. So everybody see that on the image. Okay, I'm not going to read all these names. But you'll notice that it is related to names and how these names are spelled and how we should understand these names. So, first observation is, we have not seen anything like this lettering system so far. We went through the entire Old Testament, we went through the New Testament, there was nothing like this, and then I started poking around in the apocryphal section, all of a sudden this new convention shows up that I have not observed anywhere else, and that's this lettering system, alright? So look at the bottom of page 2. The letters are clearly tied to proper names in the text. The margin appears to be giving alternative Hebrew spellings for all the names in the body of the text. Okay? So, understand that the Apocrypha section is coming from Greek, and it appears to me, this is the way I've understood it, I've run this by a couple people, they seem to agree with me, that the names in the text are more Greek-related spellings and the names in the margin are more Hebrew-related spellings. Okay? And so they seem to be doing this. That is the best observation that I can make at this time regarding this. Now, if there's somebody else out there who's watching this that has a better interpretation of that, I would be happy to hear that and engage in some conversation relative to that point. Okay? But the point right now is we haven't seen anything like this before, all right? And they're clearly corresponding with proper names in the text, okay? Are you guys seeing something I'm not, Eli?
No.
What?
We just noticed like some of the letters are missing, you know, J, B, or W, and then they start repeating the letters after they get through.
Yeah, so you're right, and the only thing I can say is I have no idea. I don't know if they thought those characters would be too confusing, or I'm not sure why they did that. But you're accurate in the observation that there are alphabet letters missing, and then you get to the bottom, and there's no Z, and then it starts over again with A right here, right? This is what you guys are observing. So it goes X. It goes X, Y, maybe that probably is a Z.
Yeah.
It's just not clear in the printed, and then it starts over with A again with the listing of these names. So there's a lettering going on here that is unlike anything that we've seen when we look at Old and New Testament marginal notes, all right? Let's go to the second category then, which is some copies on page 3. Second, there are two additional marginal notes dealing with variant readings and extant copies of First Esdras. So extant again means existing, alright? Once again, these notes use the construct, quote, some copies, like we observed when looking at similar notes in the canonical text in lessons 2.15, 2.16, 2.17. So remember we looked at that, there were a few different ways of saying that, some copies read, some ancient copies. Remember we looked at all those different variations of that. Well, now there's two occurrences of that in the text, in the marginalia for the apocryphal section. Now, the reason I didn't include those originally is because I wasn't looking at the Apocrypha. In looking at the Apocrypha, I found two more occurrences, all right? But I'm not going to go back and revise those older notes because I was real clear in those older notes that we were only looking at the canonical text, the 66 books of the Old and New Testaments, not the Apocrypha. But in looking at the Apocrypha, we now have we have two more occurrences of this, okay? So, there's a lot going on here on this page, but look right, it is right here at E. So here we have lettering again, okay? But if you look, it's kind of blurry, the screenshot is not particularly clear. But I'm looking for the E here. Where is it? I think it's right here.
Last line of 25.
First line of 25 or last line? Here's F.
Oh, it's
right there. Don't look at your hand on it.
So 1017. So you come over here, you find E, and they say, or, and there's another number here, and then notice it says according to some what? Some copies. Okay, so it's more clear there in your notes. 1017 or 217 according to some copies. So there's a pretty big difference between 1017 and 217. But they're noting there that they've seen some copies of the Apocrypha that have a different number there. Alright? Notice that, in addition to possessing the phrase some copies, this note also serves as an additional example of the lettering system noted above. Notice that this note does not have two vertical lines the way the other examples did that we looked at before. It's nestled in here with this lettering system with the E in the text directing you to the E in the margin. So there's a second example of the first category we were looking at, okay? Go to page 4. And then there's a second example here at 1 Esdras 8:2, okay? And here we have, this is again on a name here. Somebody help me with this pronunciation. Sanius? Sanius?
There's no M, but it's actually a U.
Saudis? Saudis?
Saudis.
Sure, let's go with that. Alright. So anyway, you have the two vertical lines here. You go to the margin, you have this busy, and then some copies, then it says some copies want these three names. So I'm assuming it's the three names that are marked in the verse, or it could be the three names following, which is probably more likely. So there's a name here, and a name here, okay? So it's a little unclear, like, which are the three names, unless you're counting it here. This is probably more accurate. So you have this marking, this marking, this marking. Notice, are they giving alternative spellings of the names like they did in other places? And then they're saying that some of the copies are missing these three names. Okay? That's, to me, the most accurate reading of that. Okay? So it is interesting to note that the translators use a similar marking system to identify possible variant readings in the Apocrypha as they did in the canonical text. Okay? So here we're seeing the same thing. But notice also that if these are names, now they're marked with double vertical lines, when in other places in the Apocrypha we had the names marked with the lettering system. So it's a little bit confusing. Now, I'll add this point, it's not in the notes. Many observers of the 1611 have noticed that there seems to have been far less care taken with the printing of the Apocryphal section than there was with the Old and the New Testaments. This kind of thing could possibly be a point of evidence to that, in that direction, although it's ultimately somewhat difficult to say. The point here is this: are there two times in the Apocrypha where they are noting variant readings in the extant copies of the Apocrypha that they've looked at to do this work? Okay? Now, any questions before we go on sort of the main point of the lesson? Okay. So, third point, references the Codex Vaticanus or the Roman copy. Thirdly and most importantly, there are marginal notes in the Apocrypha that explicitly reference the famous Codex Vaticanus with the statement Roman copy in the margin. Consider the following examples, okay? Now, the first one is from 1 Maccabees 9:9, okay? 1 Maccabees 9:9. So let's just first note where the note occurs. Right here, double vertical lines, directs you to the margin, and notice what they say here. We follow the Roman what?
Copy.
So are they saying there that they're following the Roman copy in that reading?
Yep.
So when the text reads here, let us now rather, yada, 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 they say they're following there the Roman copy at that reading. Is everybody with that so far? Yes? Okay, now, this gets a little complicated, so you're going to have to track with me. In this case, so in the case of 1 Maccabees 9:9, in this case, the Roman copy being referred to here is the Roman Septuagint printed in 1587. Now, this is the document I was looking for. I have my own copy of this. Here's the title page. This is a copy of the Septuagint, the Greek Old Testament, that was published by the Vatican in 1587. Okay? So when they say Roman copy, what are they referring to? This Roman Septuagint. It's called the Sixtine, because Pope Sixtus printed it. It's called the Sixtine Septuagint. Okay? So when they say, so let's go back to the notes. So in the case of, in this case, the Roman copy being referred to is the Roman Septuagint printed in 1587. Again, by the way, this copy of the Septuagint was the standard copy for like the next 300 years. So if you wanted a copy of the Septuagint in Greek, you would get it here by picking this copy up. It was the standard text of the Septuagint for the next 300 years. Interestingly enough, printed by the Vatican. All right, let's go back to the notes. Next sentence. So this occurrence in 1 Maccabees 9:9, in this case, the Roman copy being referred to here is the Roman Septuagint printed in 1587. This is not a reference to Codex Vaticanus on account of the fact that the famous Codex lacks the books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees. So if you go to Codex Vaticanus, I can show you this because I have their website marked. Which one is it? Bear with me. Where did it go? Here it is. Codex Vaticanus. This is their website. It's loading, it's thinking, it's doing its thing. You will notice. So this is a full digitization of Codex Vaticanus online. And if you look at the table of contents, you'll see I'm talking faster than the internet wants to work right now, that it does not have 1st and 2nd Maccabees. Okay? So Codex Vaticanus is missing 1st and 2nd Maccabees. So here's the table of contents. If you scroll this, you just have to take my word for it. You can look at it yourself later. If you scroll this, you will see that there is no 1st and 2nd Maccabees in Codex Vaticanus. Okay? So, in this case, when they refer to the Roman copy, they are referring to the Sixtine Septuagint from 1587. So I don't know where the Roman copy, the Sixtine Septuagint, got 1st and 2nd Maccabees from, because it's not in Codex Vaticanus. But they picked it up somewhere. I don't know if they picked it up in Latin. I don't know if they picked it up somewhere else. They don't say. But when this note here says on 1 Maccabees 9:9, when it says Roman copy, they are referring to this Sixtine Septuagint from 1587. They are not referring to the actual Codex Vaticanus, because the Codex Vaticanus does not have 1st and 2nd Maccabees. They are referring to this edition of the Septuagint published by the Vatican. So the Vatican somewhere got a text for 1st and 2nd Maccabees. I'm not familiar with where they got it from. I don't know the answer to that question right now. But in this case right here, they are referring to the Sixtine Septuagint from 1587. You with me so far? Okay? So, if you read the rest of that at the bottom of page 4, at this time it is unclear which source text the Roman Septuagint of 1587 used for the books of the Maccabees, but it was certainly not Codex Vaticanus. Now, let's go to the next one. Tobit 14 verse 5. Tobit 14 verse 5. Okay? Notice in verse 5, I'll scroll up, you can see this a little better. There's the word forever. There's two vertical lines. You go to the margin, it says forever, and then it says this is not in the Roman what? So they're saying the word forever is not where? It's not in the Roman copy. Okay? So then let's look at the point underneath that. For the variant at Tobit 14.5, Vaticanus itself, that would be this document right here, Vaticanus itself, we could go to Tobit. I'm not going to do it because I took a picture of it, but this is it right here. And you can go look at there's the beginning of Tobit and Codex Vaticanus. You can look at the actual document. The whole thing's been digitized online. Okay? So for this variant right here, Tobit 14.5, Vaticanus itself has what is in the AV's margin in the main text, i.e., it is lacking the words forever. Meanwhile, what is in the AV's text, i.e., the inclusion of the words forever, is in the margin of Vaticanus as a scribal note. Okay? So understand, what's in the King James text and what's in the King James margin, the text has the word forever, the margin says the word forever is not in the Roman manuscript, right? Okay? Both of those are coming straight out of Codex Vaticanus. Here is the entry on the Codex Vaticanus website for Tobit 14.5. Here's the main body of the text, and you'll notice, is there an alternative reading note in the margin? One of these has the words forever in it, the other one does not. So when they say, in the marginal note, forever is not in the Roman copy, are they referring to Codex Vaticanus? This time they are referring to Codex Vaticanus. Now they have access to Codex Vaticanus through what is published by the Roman One. The Roman Septuagint, the 6-time Septuagint of 1587. Okay? So they know that there is a variant in the Roman copy at that verse where one has forever and then the margin doesn't have forever, or vice versa. I might be getting it confused. Okay? So, are the King James translators aware of a variant reading in the Septuagint, in the apocryphal section of Codex Vaticanus? Shake your head yes, because that's the answer. Okay, let's look at the next one. Tobit 14.10. So, five verses later. Tobit 14.10. Notice this one. Okay? So, there is a dull vertical line at which they had set right here. You go to the margin, and it says, Roman, which he had what? Set. Let's go back to the notes. In the case of Tobit 14.10, the marginal note in the 1611 reflects the reading found in Codex Vaticanus at this verse. And I know none of you can necessarily read Greek, but I also included a screenshot of this. What they are noting here with their note, Rome, which he had set, is noting the fact that in Codex Vaticanus, it says he set, it doesn't say what? They, which they set. So are they aware of a different reading in Codex Vaticanus at Tobit 14.10? You with me? Okay? So, this is not the first time, so I'm on the bottom third of page 6. This is not the first time we have noted a connection between the apocryphal section of the 1611 and Codex Vaticanus. This subject was mentioned in Appendix A of Lesson 165 and then discussed more fully in the notes of Lesson 181. So I'm sure you all remember this. And I'm sure you all would, you know, pass the test on this and be able to know exactly which lessons I mentioned this in before, right?
Right.
Yeah, okay. Right. The following points are reproduced from Lesson 181. The reference to the Septuagint or LXX in Boyce's notes is interesting to consider. Scholar Nicholas Hardy has uncovered a copy of the Septuagint annotated in Boyce's own handwriting. So there is in existence a copy of this 1587 6-9 Septuagint that has Boyce's handwritten notes in the margin. Okay? Boyce was part of the company of translators that worked on the apocryphal section. You'll remember that he sent correspondence to the French scholar Isaac Casaubon asking him questions about it. Okay? I know you all remember this, alright? Mm-hmm. Moving on with the point. Jeffrey Miller's essay, the earliest known draft of the King James Bible, Samuel Ward's draft of 1 Esdras and Wisdom 3:4, and Laborers of the Vineyard of the Lord, Scholarship in the Making of the King James Bible, touches upon this in two different places. The first place, he says, quote, most famously, two manuscript copies have been discovered of the notes taken at the General Revisory Meeting in London by John Boyce. One of Ward's colleagues in the Second Cambridge Company. The notes span Romans to Revelation, and they provide invaluable insight into the kinds of discussions that went on at the general meeting and the rationale for some of the changes the translators had made there. They do not, though, represent a draft of the King James. They do not, though, represent a draft of the King James Bible, but rather voices personal record of part of the general meeting's proceedings. Furthermore, unfortunately, both extant versions of the notes stand only as a copy. At one, in fact, being a copy of a copy, and neither, perhaps the full one of Boyce's original notes themselves, which surely would have been in Boyce's own hand, and which has never been found. The notes also, of course, belong to an even later stage of the Bible's composition process, the general meeting, than at least two of the drafts already discussed, namely the Bodleian's Annotated Gospels and the Lambeth Palace draft of the New Testament epistles. So we've talked about all those already. That's manuscript 98, and that's the document Bod 1602, which I made a video about this morning, by the way. The Bodleian Library has finally digitized the entirety of Bod 1602. So you can go to this website and you can look at every page, look at every note they made, every scratch out they made, every overwrite they made. You can look at the whole thing now. I just found out about this on Friday. And of course it comes out when we're done studying it. But whatever. Next paragraph. The last item that bears noting here has only recently been identified, and it likewise goes back to Boyce, in this case even more directly. One more in the Bodleian, there exists a heavily annotated copy of the 1587 Roman Septuagint, a landmark edition of the Greek text, and thanks to the work of Nicholas Hardy, we now know this to have been Boyce's own copy, with the annotations being in Boyce's own hand. That means his own handwriting. It appears to have been used by Boyce during his work as a translator, both with the Second Cambridge Company and later as a member of the General Revisory Meeting. Boyce's Septuagint represents a treasure trove of scholars, not just of the King James Bible, but of early modern theological and intellectual history as a whole. Again, however, it does not stand as a draft itself of the King James translation, but rather as something, even the most important thing, that Boyce used in his process of work as a translator on the various portions of the text with which he was involved. So that's the first quote from that essay. And then there's an additional quote a few pages later from page 230, quote, "To begin with, given the recent identification of John Boyce's aforementioned copy of the 1587 Roman Septuagint," and again, that's this one right here. He had one of these, and he wrote in it in his own handwriting. Okay, this has been discovered also in the Bodleian Library. "Heavily annotated in Boyce's own hand and seemingly used by him in working on the King James translation. One might have expected this to have been the version of the Septuagint from which Ward himself worked in translating 1st Esdras and Wisdom. The 1587 Roman edition was the first and through the time of the King James Bible, the only edition of the Septuagint to be based upon the manuscript known as Codex what? Vaticanus. In the years when Boyce and Ward would have been working as translators for decades thereafter, many considered Codex Vaticanus to be the best manuscript witness known to survive of the Septuagint's original Greek, and this accordingly gave the Roman edition of the text strong claim to being the most authoritative edition of the Septuagint available. It would be, for example, the version of the Septuagint printed in the London Polyglot Bible of 1653 through 1657. At least with respect to 1st Esdras, however, Ward appears not to have used the Roman Septuagint as his primary copy." Okay? And then we also said about that, top page 8, these are my statements, "The references to Codex Vaticanus are interesting to say the least." So this is me still in lesson 181 commenting on what we just read. Okay? "The references to Codex Vaticanus are interesting to say the least. It is important to note that all printed editions of the LXX, or the Septuagint, are based upon Codex Vaticanus and Codex Sinaiticus, or some combination thereof. When Pastor Lee died a few years ago, he had in his library a Septuagint. It was a Greek-English Septuagint. It had the Greek in the middle, and then it had the English translation around the columns. And I when I went through his library, I took it and added it to my own. Okay? All known printed copies of the Septuagint today are a combination of Codex Vaticanus and Codex Sinaiticus. You following that? Okay? Furthermore, it was only the Old Testament and apocryphal sections of Codex Vaticanus that would be found within the Roman edition of 1587. So when this edition is printed in 1587, they don't print the New Testament. They are only printing the Old Testament and the canonical Old Testament, Genesis through Malachi, plus the apocryphal books. Rome is printing in their 6-kind edition of 1587. They are not printing the New Testament. They're only printing the Old Testament and the Apocrypha. You with that? So put another way, the New Testament section of the controversial Roman Codex was not in print until the 19th century. No one bothered to print the New Testament section of Codex Vaticanus for another 300 plus years. Okay? Now that tells you that they thought very highly of it, so they didn't print it. Or they thought very or it wasn't thought of very highly, so they didn't print it. Which one? A or B?
B.
Okay? So, put another way, the New Testament section of the controversial Roman Codex was not in print until the 19th century. This does not mean, however, that Protestant scholars of the late 16th and early 17th century were wholly unaware of the Codex's controversial New Testament readings. In the 1520s and 30s, via correspondence with his friends Bombastius and Sepulveda, Erasmus had been made aware of some important textual variations, 1 John 5:7 and 365 other readings found within Codex Vaticanus. Erasmus viewed the Codex as part of a, quote, medieval move from the Council of Florence, 1413 to 1499, to conform Greek manuscripts to the Latin Vulgate. Consequently, most of the variant New Testament readings found in B, that would be Codex Vaticanus, were left out of printed editions of the Textus Receptus. So in other words, there's this idea that exists amongst the modern text critical community that they just didn't know about this. And they didn't know what the New Testament variants were in Codex Vaticanus, and if they did, they certainly would have used that, and they would have identified the Codex Vaticanus as being more ancient and older, and therefore a better representation of the New Testament, okay? The evidence is to the contrary here, folks. Did Erasmus know about some of the principal textual variants in Codex Vaticanus in the 1520s and 1530s when he was working on his editions of the Greek New Testament? The answer is yes, okay? And was the Old Testament and apocryphal section of the Codex very well known and in print and available to the King James translators? You following that? Okay, anybody got any questions so far? So, let's go to the conclusion. So I don't know if we're going to be done early or not, or if there's going to be questions or what, but we're going to go through this slow and make sure everybody understands. Page 8. In addition to these prior statements, we can now add proof from the marginalia of the 1611 that Codex Vaticanus was directly utilized by the King James translators when they worked on the Apocrypha. Okay, now how do I know? Because of these two marginal notes here at Tobit 14:5. Forever, not in the Roman copy, and at Tobit 14:10, okay, Rome which had, he had, instead of they what? They had. So let's go back to that statement. I'm going to leave these pictures up. In addition to these prior statements, so that would be the stuff I said in lesson 181. In addition to these prior statements, we can now add proof from the marginalia of the 1611 that Codex Vaticanus was directly utilized by the King James translators who worked on the Apocrypha. Now, guys, I've never heard anybody talk about this. I've never heard this mentioned. I've never even heard proponents of the modern critical text and modern versions talk about this. I've never heard anybody talk about this before until Alex Hanna showed it to me, and I went and investigated it on the Facebook post where this guy was talking about it. Okay? This new discovery in the marginalia to the 1611 adds an interesting wrinkle to the pro-King James side of the debate regarding text and translation. Erasmus lived with Bombastius in Rome for the better part of a year. Nothing documents Erasmus inspecting Vaticanus during that time, but it is inconceivable that that would not have happened. Now that is somewhat possibly conjecture. But if he was there, do you think he would have looked at it if he had opportunity to do so?
Yeah.
I would say that is a reasonable assumption. Okay? There is extant correspondence between Erasmus and Bombastius as the former prepared his Greek text, which discusses more than 300 variants that are present in Vaticanus. So we know there's an extant discussion of them talking about the variations within Codex Vaticanus. In the end, none of the Vaticanus readings made it into the Erasmine Greek New Testament. None. Therefore, the implication is that Erasmus regarded them as corruptions. But how